This is HR in Review, a podcast dedicated to HR thought leadership, actionable advice, and all the latest developments in human resource management.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of HR in Review. I am Amelia Brand, your host for today. And in this episode, we're talking about two important employment law topics. In the first half, we explore the increases in civil penalties for employers employing illegal workers. And in the second half, we talk about the statutory code of practice on the controversial fire and rehire policies. Joining me in the first half is Stephen Mutch, who is the Director of Employment and HR at Pernone Corporate, a commercial law firm. Stephen provides employment advice to clients across a wide range of sectors, which includes the provision of effective day-to-day HR practice. Hi, Stephen. Welcome. It's great to have you on the HR in Review podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm very well. It's an absolute pleasure to be here. Thank you for having us on.
Great. So firstly then, would you like to tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and what it is you do?
Yeah, so I'm a director in the employment team here at Pernone Corporate. And what I do is I give sort of strategic HR advice to businesses across a wide variety of sectors. So any kind of employment or personnel issues or changes they're wanting to make, they come and speak to me about it to try and avoid them getting sued and ending up in an employment tribunal. So I do that. And then I also, when they steadfastly ignore my advice and end up in an employment tribunal, I also defend those claims on behalf of our clients as well.
Lovely. So today we're talking about the increases in civil penalties for employers hiring illegal workers. A good place to start then is perhaps if you could explain to our listeners a little bit about those penalties and why they've been increased.
Yeah, so it's part of the government's ongoing commitment to tackle immigration issues and illegal immigration. The government believes, probably rightly, that the ability to find work illegally is one of the main drivers that affects illegal immigration. So as part of the government's focus on these issues, it is ramping up its focus on illegal working. So that's the reason why the fines are increasing. It's part of a sort of wider focus on it. They're upping the number of visits that employers get. They're rather scarily called compliance visits, which sounds very 1984, doesn't it? But that is the Home Office team coming in to audit businesses. So they're saying we're going to check up on you more often, and we're going to up the fines, hopefully in a drive to reduce illegal working. The figures, when you look at them, for the fines that have been issued over the previous period, it's pretty eye-watering, the figures, so get ready. But in the last 6 years, 5,000 civil penalties, individual penalties, worth £88.4 million. And in a six-month spell last year, they issued over £9 million in fines. So this is speculation, but I don't know whether the government is thinking that it's handing out so many fines that it's not having the required effect. So there's a couple of reasons, I think, why the penalties are going up.
That's a huge number. Blimey.
It's pretty eye-watering. Not uncommon. We see clients. I have dealt with a number of clients that have been issued with fines. And you'd be surprised. They're in and out. They're pretty quick. And the fines, there is a fairly sort of formulaic way of calculating it. When you're talking about minimum and maximum fines, they're usually round figures, you know, and there's a fair simplistic way of calculating it, which we can come on to and I can go into in detail, but you know, it's not uncommon. I've known for a number of businesses, they get audited, come in, slap with some pretty eye-watering fines.
So you obviously want to avoid facing such penalties then. Could you give any advice over what an employer can do if they're actually facing a fine like this?
Yeah, so, well, the if you've actually been fined, the advice is usually take your medicine, get your wallet out, pay the fine, but then look at your systems going forward. There are Well, you can appeal a civil penalty in the civil courts, like you would any other kind of judgment. Almost nobody does that because it's quite expensive. There is a specific internal process called an objection process, whereby you can object the fine that's been issued. However, those are only really where the Home Office has got it wrong. So effectively, if you can say, well, we shouldn't have been fined, this person did have the right to work in the UK, so the fine shouldn't have been issued. That's really what you're talking about, because in terms of the level of the fine, there is actually a front-loaded process. So there are sort of mitigating circumstances that the enforcement bodies look at when they issue the fine. So there are mechanisms for seeking to reduce or avoid the fine, but most of the time it's pay up and then get proper systems in place so you're not caught out in the future. That's what the vast majority of my clients have done.
Right. Okay. So are there any specific industries perhaps, or even sectors that are particularly vulnerable to employing legal workers?
The ones that we see most often probably won't come as a surprise to anybody, but it is usually in industries that have low paid workers and high turnover. Yeah. Because the issue is, if someone's coming into work for 2 or 3 weeks for you, businesses don't want to invest in the infrastructure for the required checks. So the sort of gig economy, hospitality, anything where you've got large numbers of low-paid workers and quite a transient or a workforce with a high turnover. And the other industry that gets a lot of publicity around it are industries that historically employ a lot of non-British workers. Mm. So the care industry is a prime example of that. Very high proportion of non-British employees, and so they are all too commonly the names that you sort of see.
I mean, something that springs to mind immediately for me is something with a high turnover, perhaps like hospitality.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the specialisms I have is acting for clients in the events or hospitality space. So I act for a number of the larger sort of events venues in Manchester, up here in Manchester, and wider as well. And certainly, yes, there is an issue with more casual workforces, lower paid employees. In fact, the real issue that we see is because the way to avoid these fines it's not actually about employing illegal workers. It's about demonstrating that you've done the right checks. Mm. So there is something called a statutory defence. So effectively, if you've carried out sufficient right to work checks, and that will be different depending on where the individual is from, but you can demonstrate that you have done those, then that is what we call a statutory defence to the fine. So even if it turns out that they were working illegally, as long as you have done your bit and done the checks in the appropriate way and kept a record of it, then you are not liable for a fine. What we see is most clients that I deal with are very good at doing it when people join. So they are set up for when someone comes in, you know, let's see a copy of your passport, if it's someone from the UK, or the various online checks and other document checks that need to be done for where people were not born in the UK. But what we see is coming up time and time again is there are a number of sort of time limited rights to work in the UK. So student visas, again, is a very common example of this, especially in the hospitality sector, where people are coming in and working for a limited period. What that means is there's an expiration date on their right to work in the UK, and it's the follow-up checks that are not done. So a check is done when they start, and then their right to work expires after 6 months or 3 months or 9 months or whatever it might be, and it's those that are causing employees problems. The biggest single example of a client, which obviously I won't name, who got fined was in relation to this. It was a number of student workers. There were three of them. Their right to work had expired because it was time limited only, and it cost the employer £45,000.
Wow.
And it was pretty much the piece of paper the fines were written on was pretty short, let me tell you. you know, these people don't have the right to work. We've looked at the mitigating factors, which we've discussed. Here's your fine for 45 grand. Wow. And the advice, again, to the client was pay it. And then let's discuss how not to get fined in the future. So and now, again, in terms of the fines themselves, that they're very keen on trying to get compliance. So there was a difference between first time offenders and repeat offenders. And so the fines used to be up to £15,000 for a first offence. It's now up to £45,000 per individual, yeah, even for a first offence. And for repeated offenders, so again, this is a real problem for large scale workforces. You know, we've got a number of clients that employ 8,000-10,000 people, and the numbers game alone says your systems might fall down more than once. And so the fine for repeated offences is up from £20,000 to £60,000 per individual. So you could have a situation where you've dropped the ball with three individuals. It's not the first time it's happened, and you get charged £180,000 for people who are on £12 an hour and worked for you for, you know, 3 days. It's pretty salutary in terms of what it looks like, and again, the mitigating circumstances. So the circumstances in which the fines are reduced are quite limited. They are basically, we held our hand up to the Home Office ourselves, so self-reporting, and then cooperating with the Home Office when they arrive at your premises to go through the record. So you can get a reduction to the fines for sort of being helpful in the investigation.
Well, I mean, still £60,000, that's got to hurt, hasn't it?
No one's paying that lightly. Like I said, they're block fines, they're standard fines. You can't sort of say we're a small business or it's not that. You know, clearly set out formulaic approach to how the fines are looked at. You've either got mitigating circumstances or you haven't. And so you're either paying top whack. They start at the top and then look to reduce it. So basically, if it's a repeat offence, you didn't report it to the Home Office yourself, and they felt that you perhaps didn't cooperate with them when they turned up and sort of booted the doors in to check your records, then it's the top fine. You know, so it's a concern for businesses. But the only better news, I suppose, is that this system has been in place for many years now. Employers should have the correct systems in place. It is not rocket science, but what it does require is it requires sufficient training for staff on how to carry out these checks, and also resourcing effectively. If you have enough people whose responsibility it is to make sure these checks are carried out, who have the sufficient training, it shouldn't be difficult. It's not a difficult thing to do. It's an administrative exercise. There is an awful lot of guidance. So there's a code of practice that's issued by the Home Office. There's also an employer's guide, which is sort of 70 pages. It's got lovely glossy pictures in there in terms of how to carry out these right to work checks and what you need to do in each individual circumstance. So it's not new. Employers should be doing this already. So all those employers who are behaving themselves and doing the right things, this isn't news, because they weren't going to get fined then. They're not going to get fined now. That should be the case. But it is certainly a wake-up call for employees to look at their systems, to make sure that they are reviewed regularly, to make sure they're fit for purpose. Because again, like with a lot of internal systems, it gets set up, it then, you know, goes by the wayside and people don't keep up with it.
Interesting. You mentioned there the impact that these large huge amounts of money and fines will have on larger companies, and that kind of leads me to wonder, how does this impact global companies? How do increases in civil penalties impact recruitment and hiring processes for employers with global operations?
Yeah, so it's there's a couple of ways that we see that coming into play. The first is where a global company has a limited Involvement in the UK. So we have a number of clients where, you know, they're based predominantly in Europe, but they have maybe three or four sales guys in the UK to deal with the UK arm. And then it's a lack of knowledge and a lack of availability of resources and the like. So we see some issues with that. Some of the larger companies, if you employ 1,000 people in every country in Europe, then you're going to have enough employees, you've got the systems in place. It's the sort of smaller employees, you might have more limited operations. And the second thing we see is where you have global companies where the senior management team are moved around. So, you have a hotshot troubleshooter guy based in Luxembourg. The UK sales arm is not doing very well. Right, let's parachute him in to bang on some tables and get things sorted. That person is then working in the UK, or maybe in the circumstances working in the UK. Have you done the right to work checks in those circumstances? So they're the sort of two common situations that we see cropping up with global companies.
Great. But before that, you did kind of touch on the code of practice. I'd just love to, you know, for a second, dive into that a little bit deeper. Perhaps you could explain for our listeners exactly what the code of practice is and then how it can actually help prevent illegal working.
Yeah, so there's two documents. So there's the original code of practice, and the code of practice effectively sets out when fines are issued and how they are calculated. So that is the document that the Home Office look at and use to decide whether a fine should be issued and what the level of that fine is. And it's quite detailed. So that's the code of practice. Of more use to the employers is a document called the Employer's Guide. So it's the Employer's Guide to Preventing Illegal Working. That's a 70-page document which goes into great detail about when checks are required, what level of checks are required, what you're supposed to be doing. It's well written, it's in plain English. You don't need to be a lawyer to make your way through it, sadly. So clients can look at it themselves and make head and tail of it. But it's a very useful document. If you have a uncertainty or a question about what you're supposed to do in a particular scenario, because the right to work check is not one thing, you know, it's looking at, you know, if someone's from the UK, it's checking their passport. If depending on the country that the individual is from, there is a whole raft of various things and the type of right to work that they have. There are lots of differing checks that may be required, but it takes you through all of those basically. So it's a very useful document to use to set up the systems that you need to put in place, and secondly to deal with the more unusual circumstance that you might have where someone's from a less common a part of the world and there are different checks that are needed.
Great. Well, it's glad to hear the code of practice is relatively simple to read and understand.
Yes, less work for us lawyers, sadly, but the Home Office has done a good job of writing the guidance.
Well, it's been great talking to you. But before I let you go, I'm going to ask you two questions that I ask all of my guests on the HR in Review podcast. Firstly, if you could pass on one crucial lesson you've learned in your career in 1 minute or less, if you can, what would be your top tip for other HR pros?
Well, I've got two that I'm going to try and squeeze into in the minute. The first is a attractive soundbite, given it's a podcast. Look before you leap. Mm. The most common thing I hear when employees run into trouble, the conversation starts, "I've just come out of a meeting." So the advice I would give is to take proper advice before you go into that meeting. Taking advice on what your options are and what the appropriate course of action might be before you start down any course of action would slash my workload in half. Look before you leap is the first tip. If you're unsure, take some advice before you have a conversation with the colleague, before you decide how you're going to deal with any workplace issue. And the second one, again, if I had a pound for every time I heard this, saying without prejudice before you have a conversation with your employee very rarely does little, if anything, at all. Mm. People seem to think that it's sort of, it will make things off the record. It means they can say what they like to a particular individual employee if they use these magic legal words without prejudice. That is not true. It's never been true. And it gets some employers into hot water.
Great, thanks for that. Just over a little bit of a minute, Stephen, but I'll let you off.
I'll play mitigation for that. If that was okay. There was two of them, so I think I'm allowed a couple of seconds.
You're allowed. And lastly, then, what is the single biggest change you think will happen in HR over the next 5 to 10 years?
Well, I'm going to avoid the answer that everybody gives, which is talking about artificial intelligence, because I think you will have had 50 answers that say it's artificial intelligence. There's no doubt that that is going to be a huge change, and it's going to be a market change, specifically in the HR space. But I think, avoiding that, I think there's a big thing talking about remote working, because I think as the workforce demographic of the workforce changes, you are going to get more and more people of a younger generation for whom flexibility, remote working, and sort of work-life balance and an ability to sort of shape your work around your life is going to be increasingly more important. And I think to retain talent and move forward as a businesses, a lot of businesses are going to have to grapple with that and have to start sort of getting rid of some of their older ideas about what a productive workforce looks like. And I think that's going to be a big change that's going to be coming in.
Yeah, definitely. Well, it's been great having you on the HR and Review podcast today, Stephen. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
My second guest is Michael McNally, an associate partner at Pannone Corporate. He advises employers on all aspects of employment law, which includes providing regular representation and advocacy in the employment tribunal. Hi, Michael. Welcome. It's great to have you on the HR in Review podcast today. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks, Amelia. And yourself?
Great, thank you. So firstly, would you like to tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and what it is you do?
Yeah, sure. So my name is Michael McNally, and I'm an associate partner in the employment and HR team at Pannone Corporate LLP. Pannone are a boutique commercial law firm based in Manchester. The employment team, we mainly act for employers, right from startups through to large multinational corporations. Myself, I've been practicing employment law for nearly 20 years now, and I advise on all aspects of employment law, from day-to-day advice, strategic advice, corporate support, right through to appearing on behalf of clients in the employment tribunal. So that's just a little bit about myself.
Great, thanks for that, Michael. So today we're talking about the controversial fire and rehire practices. Mm-hmm. And a good place to start then is with definitions. So perhaps you could explain for our listeners exactly what is fire and rehire and why is it used?
Yeah, sure. So fire and rehire, it's what most people will know it as. We as employment lawyers tend to refer to dismissal and re-engagement. So sounds maybe a little less controversial when you put it like that. So basically what it is, it's when an employer chooses to terminate the existing terms and conditions of an employee and offer them new terms on a new contract of employment, hence the fire, i.e. termination of the old contract, and rehire, offer of re-engagement on a new contract. Strictly speaking, that is the correct way to refer to it as. It's your existing employees who are offered new contracts and their old ones will terminate. But in the ACAS code of practice and certainly the media, it will also be talked of as fire and rehire if an employer dismisses its current workforce and re-engages completely different employees but on new terms and conditions. And basically, it tends to arise when an employer wants to change the terms and conditions of an existing employee or employees. It tends to be done on more of a large scale basis, but it can't reach agreement with the employees or their representatives, and there's no contractual right to make those changes. So basically, what the employer says in those circumstances is, we'd like to propose changes to your terms and conditions, but if we can't reach agreement, we may consider dismissal and re-engagement on new terms. And if the employee accepts that, well, then the employment continues on new terms. And if they reject the new terms, then their employment will end. An alternative to fire and rehire is that the employer, if they can't reach agreement, could unilaterally change contracts of employment. So we could simply say, as of this date, you are now on a different rate of pay, or you work different hours. The problem with that is, if there's no contractual right to make those changes, then it would be a breach of contract that would entitle the employee to resign and claim constructive dismissal. Or more commonly, if, for example, the change, and it typically is a change to remuneration in some way when you go down the fire and rehire route, if the employee simply unilaterally made those changes under the existing contract, the employee could say, well, I'm going to work under protest. And in that scenario, they continue to bring claims for whatever breach. So if the employee's paying them less than they did previously, they would continue to bring wage claims against their existing contract. If you go down the dismissal and re-engagement route, that contract is terminated, and therefore the employee cannot do that because they'd be employed on a completely new contract of employment. So it doesn't remove risks when you go down that route, but if an employer's got to go down that route, it tends to be a cleaner way of effecting changes when you don't have the right and you can't get the employee to agree to the changes.
Great, that sounds relatively complicated, so thank you for explaining that to me and our listeners. So a statutory code of practice was published earlier this year, I think it was in February, clear how employers must behave in this area. Could you explain perhaps why this code has been issued exactly?
Yeah, so I think that it primarily stems from a case that, well, a matter that was reported in the mainstream media and as well as the specialist media, and that was when P&O back in 2022 dismissed 800 employees, and I think it was on a 24-second video that was communicated to the employees, because they had decided that they were going to source their staff from third-party agencies. So strictly speaking, the P&O scenario, as I mentioned before, wasn't fired and rehired as we conventionally know it, because it was new employees they were going to recruit in place of their existing employees. But off the back of that, what happened is it got a lot of attention in the media. The trade unions, obviously, who have always been against this practice, raised a lot of issues with it. I believe Labour have said that if they get into power, that they may consider making it unlawful. So really, that prompted the government to do something, and it announced the consultation at the start of last year, and it subsequently introduced the statutory code of practice, which there's not a specific date for when it comes into force, but the government have said it's going to come into force before the end of this current parliament, which is the middle of July. So at some point, probably around July, it's going to come into practice.
Great. I know you also touched on risks a little bit earlier, but let's quickly touch back on that again for a bit. Could you perhaps explain what are the potential liabilities are for employers considering such process, and what this statutory code actually means for employers in practice?
Yes, the main employment risks are, obviously, I mentioned a couple, that if the employer sought to unilaterally impose changes, if they go down the dismissal and re-engagement route, the legal risks are, if it involves 20 or more employees, then the employer would have to collectively consult with employees, which means there's minimum consultation periods and there can be penalties if they don't collectively consult properly. Because the employee's employment contract is terminating, then it is a termination. So employees could potentially bring unfair dismissal claims and claims of discrimination related to their dismissal. If the employees accept the new terms, there don't tend to be any claims, but it still is a dismissal. And as I just mentioned then, as with any scenario where you're seeking to impose something and maybe terminate employment, there's always risks of other claims, such as discrimination. Under the code of practice, it doesn't implement any new legal obligations as such. What it says is, this is best practice as set out in the code of practice, and if you don't follow it, it can be referred to as evidence in any legal proceedings. And if we find that you haven't complied with the code of practice on the employer's part, then compensation can increase by up to 25%. The flip side is if the employee representative, so the trade union typically, or the employees don't comply with their obligations under the code of practice, then compensation can be reduced by up to 25%. So the code of practice, what it primarily does is set out existing best practice. So if we ever advise on dismissal and re-engagement, what's in the code of practice now about don't use it as an empty threat, use it as a last resort, consider alternatives, consult with the employees, all of those best practice suggestions that we would typically advise, they've been put into the code of practice. It now has some clout, if you like, because there's that potential increase of 25% in compensation. The only sort of novel new requirement of the code of practice is that before raising the possibility of dismissal and re-engagement, employers now need to contact ACAS for advice. It's not really clear what form that advice would take, but that is the only strict requirement as a result of this code of practice that wasn't there beforehand.
Surely then employers should really focus on maintaining good employment relations to reach an agreement with staff if they're thinking about making changes to their contracts then. Leading on from that then, could you discuss any potential kind of long-term effects of fire and rehire practices on employee retention and also talent acquisition as well?
Yeah, so what typically happens is if this is raised as a possibility, it can obviously, even if it doesn't happen, can sour relations, because what you're essentially saying then as an employer is we're willing to take the nuclear option if you don't agree to this. And it can sometimes be seen by the trade unions and employees as they're trying to bully us into these changes. If the changes are implemented by dismissal and re-engagement, then typically it's going to be the employees that on some of their terms and conditions are now worse than they were before. So that certainly leads to a lot of employees being disgruntled, even though they may accept the changes. What we sometimes see is that employees are then on the lookout for new employment when the opportunity arises. It also tends to provoke, particularly if the unions are involved, it tends to provoke bad publicity for the employer. So if you were to Google fired and rehire, the P&O case pops up, but there's also been scenarios with the likes of BA, British Airways, Centrica, where simply the threat of fired and rehire in the context of needing to make changes to terms and conditions has led to a lot of bad publicity. And obviously that impacts on the employer brand, the ability to recruit and obviously keeping employees on a long-term basis as well.
I mean, it's interesting there, you just listed quite a few relatively high profile cases where this has kind of gone a little bit skew, and kind of leads me to ask you if you can perhaps outline the key takeaways and or messages for businesses when considering changes to their employees' terms.
So the first one, and this applies to a lot of employment advice, but something employers don't always do, is I would always suggest get your business case in order before you go down the route of even considering the changes. So why do you need to make the changes? Why do you feel that changing the terms and conditions is going to help you achieve whatever the business goal is? Spend some time on that, because it will help the employer sell the idea of changes when it comes to discussing it with the employees and the trade unions. But also, having thought through your business case for making these changes, it tends to put you in a better position to defend any legal proceedings. Be willing, and the guidance makes this clear, that the code of practice makes this clear, that it's a really important factor, is be willing to engage with the trade unions and the employees, be willing to be as transparent as possible. And obviously, this type of thing is not something that should, it's actually quite rare that this happens. It's sometimes raised as a possibility, but for it to actually happen is fairly rare. So the other one bit of a plug for lawyers is take legal advice. It's not something an employer should be doing without having really thought about its reasons and then taking advice on the best approach.
Nice. But what about alternative strategies? Are there any kind of other practices employers can consider instead of resorting to these fire and rehire methods?
So I think you touched on the main one just before, Amelia, is that maintaining good employee relations and getting their agreement to the changes is the best way of having to avoid this, because typically it comes in because employers find that whatever terms and conditions employees are currently on are either not commercially viable, so typically that they're getting paid too much, whether it be allowances or overtime and things like that, or the current practices simply don't work and allow the employer to service the stakeholders in the way that they require. So there's often good reasons as to why this is raised. But the best way of getting it through is to be able to agree that. Sometimes it may also be better. Fire and rehire is sometimes seen as an alternative to having to make redundancies. Yeah. But it actually might sometimes be better to make redundancies. So if you've got a scenario where we can change the terms and conditions of 100 employees, or we can make 5 redundancies, it might actually be weighing up which long-term is going to have a bigger impact on employee morale and the employer brand. The other thing that an employer can do, but this is before this scenario ever arises, is just keep contracts and policies under review. For example, in contracts, do you have some ability to make changes? Now, that won't always get you around this issue, but making sure where you think you might need to make changes, there is some provision in the contract to do that under the contract might help. Also considering how you apply policies. So for example, if what we sometimes see is an employer had what was a discretionary policy, say some sort of discretionary payments, over time, there's become a concern that may no longer be discretionary. So we then advise, well, you need to consider changing it as a contractual term. If those policies have been kept under review, communicated in the correct way, it may never have been the case that we had to worry about it becoming a contractual term. So thinking in advance about what's in those policies and contracts can future-proof the employer, if you like.
I mean, yeah, it's really interesting what you said there about, you know, making sure you avoid getting a bad rep and thinking long term. And it's actually been really interesting chatting to you today. So thanks a lot, Michael. But before you go, I have 2 questions that we ask all of our guests on the HR in Review podcast. Mm-hmm. And the first question, if you could pass on one crucial lesson you've learned in your career in 1 minute or less, what would be your top tip for other HR pros?
So from my perspective, what obviously people say that the law is really complicated, it's too difficult for employers. When it comes to things like managing day-to-day capability, conduct, performance and that, the law is actually quite sympathetic to employers. But obviously the reality means that people can sometimes get sort of caught up in the moment. So mine would be 3 tips for anyone dealing with day-to-day HR issues such as that. And it is do things for the right reasons. So for the good of the business, the good of the team, not out of anger, revenge or for unlawful reasons. Treat people like you'd like to be treated, which is something people can easily forget in the heat of the moment. And providing you're doing it all for the right reasons, document what, why, how and when you're doing something. If it's documented, us lawyers love that because it makes it much easier to justify why you've done what you've done.
Great. And lastly then, what is the single biggest change you think will happen in HR over the next 5 to 10 years?
I think it's probably the one that will apply certainly to law and most other industries. It's AI. It's going to be impact on recruitment, impact on how we manage staff. I don't see it as taking over from HR professionals or lawyers. I see it as being a companion. I think the way we work going forward. So I can envisage a scenario where a particular issue can be input into AI. AI can come back with suggested ways of dealing with it. And the role of the human is then to sort of check what AI said and add that human touch into it. So I very much see that being something that's going to be a big factor in the way we go forward in employment law and HR generally.
Yeah, AI is such a buzzword at the moment, isn't it?
Everywhere, yeah. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Michael. It's great to talk to you.
No problem. Cheers, Amelia.
The HR and Review podcast is brought to you by hrreview.co.uk. hrreview.co.uk is a website dedicated to human resources and related professionals. News items are posted daily together with analysis looking in depth at topical HR issues. You can sign up for our range of specialist newsletters at hrreview.co.uk/signup and follow us on Twitter at HRReview or join us on LinkedIn and Facebook. Thank you for listening.